This is The Guardian.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Today, another in the Life and Time series that you enjoyed during the pandemic. I guess there wasn't much on, but we like making them and learning about our panellists. This episode is all about Nicky Bandini, so expect to hear about mid-90s Arsenal, Football Italia and living in the US. As most of you know, Nicky came out publicly as transgender about 4 years ago. We will, of course, discuss that, but this is about her love of football and the journey in the game that has led her to be sitting on a Zoom call with me and Barry right now. This is the Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, hello.
Hello.
Hi, Nicky. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah. I'm a bit nervous. It's weird talking about yourself. Yeah. Like, I, you know, like it's so silly, but like as a journalist, like you spend all your time talking about other people. And like when the lens is turned on you, it's a bit different.
Yeah. I didn't want to, in the intro, it made it sound like all your career had been leading to the moment where you were on a Zoom call with me and Barry.
It has, obviously.
Yeah, of course, yeah. A career highlight. Lots of people got in touch. DB says, no questions. Looking forward to this one. I listen to every Football Weekly, but I hit download with greater urgency when Nicky is on. I really enjoy the way she thinks about football. So I agree with that, actually. I don't sound surprised. And I also like how all the panelists think about football, as I cover myself. A storyteller opening the door to new and imaginative ways of loving the game. So no pressure. Nicky, let's start with an easy one there. I feel like I sort of should know these things about panelists, but I don't. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
So I was born in London, grew up in London. My dad is Italian. He grew up in Italy and moved to Italy when he was in his 20s, met my mum, and they stayed in London. So yeah, I was born and grew up in London.
Whereabouts?
All over, really. I mean, sort of west-ish mostly, but like we moved 7 times, I think, between me being born and me going to university. So, like, we moved a lot. I was born in North London, but, yeah, we really bounced around.
And your earliest memories of football?
Yeah, I think it's a bit hard, isn't it? Because I don't know if other people have, like, more clearly, like, boxed memories than I do. I think, like, when I sort of go to, like, a certain bit of youth, it's all a bit blurry. But I'm pretty sure my first memory of football is really, like, the 1990 World Cup. Because that's the first time when I remember like really paying attention to it. And I, again, like this is still pretty young, so I don't remember it very clearly, but I remember the sort of thing of everyone being around the telly together and watching this big sporting event. And I really remember the third, fourth game, almost more than the games before. I remember the games before it like a little bit. And I sort of always wonder with memories like that, how much do I remember it and how much have I just rewatched it as an adult and sort of superimpose those things. But I really remember the third, fourth game because there was this big discussion in the household about whether we were going to support England or Italy. Yeah. Because I've got an older brother and I've got an Italian dad and I've got an English mum. And so like you had to like pick a side. And I'm sure you didn't, but it felt like you definitely did as a kid. And I picked Italy. And I don't have like a really like logical, because I was 6. My birth's in the summer, 6 or 7 years old. I just realized I've just completely like literally given people my exact age there, which is not a thing I'd intended to do at the start, but there you go. I chose Italy and I felt like it was because of like a few characters. Like I know everyone was crazy for Scalacci. My dad was crazy for Scalacci. I really loved Walter Senger. And I remember having been sort of quite affronted because people got quite angry about him after they went out. But I liked him because he was very, I think as a kid, I was very drawn to quite like extroverted people, like people who stood out. And like Zenga had that thing of like on the pitch, like you noticed him, like obviously like goalkeepers, you notice more anyway, because they're different. Like they're the ones who are different to everyone else. But he also had a way of doing it that was very sort of on the front foot, you know, making himself visible, coming out more than he probably should have done sometimes. And that I was drawn to. And I think probably on top of that, there was like another part of it, which is just like my older brother was sort of by character a bit more sort of quiet than I was. And in our household, somehow this got sort of told as a story of, well, it's English to be reserved and quiet and it's Italian to be outspoken and loud.
So he chose England, did he? I mean,
he did. Right. Yeah. I think he's switched over the years, because I mean we watched the 2006 final together and he was unambiguous in enjoying that, and honestly, like when I've talked to him more recently about it, I think he finds it easier to support in Italy than England as well.
So you sort of chose Italy then, and then it grew up, then your sort of love of Italian football sort of grows from there.
I honestly think it is probably still like another few years before I'm really properly engaged in football. I think it's really interesting, like how we come to like these sort of things that become huge parts of our lives, because even though the World Cup was a big deal and it was in Italy, my dad wasn't really a football fan. My dad was really the only sort of, well, no, his brother isn't that much of a football fan either, but a lot of the Italian family are football fans, and he wasn't. My dad liked tennis, but what he really liked, my dad, was being Italian, as ridiculous as that sounds. Like he,
right,
you know, like there was a World Cup in Italy, so he was incredibly proud of the fact there was a World Cup in Italy and we could all talk about Italy and how great it is. He you know, getting behind the Italian national team was a big thing. But once it was over, he was again not fussed about football, so I didn't really pay attention to it again for a while. And you know, this is sort of one of the things where like it's hard to talk about this in a way that isn't a bit odd, because I am trans, but like I went to an all boys school, and I think that for me coming to football again, like in a more sort of concerted way, was partly just because I went to school and like everyone liked football. Like I wasn't that fussed about football when I first went to that school at 8 years old. Like I know I had like other things I was interested in before the age of eight, and like, you know, in the breaks, everyone played football and it was like, okay. And I wasn't very good at it, but like I joined in. And like, I think a lot of it for me, like grows from there. Like, you know, you play football because the other people who you're sort of stuck with for most of the day, that's what they want to do.
Most people in the UK of a certain age got into Italian football because of James Richardson and his shows on Channel 4 every Saturday and Sunday.
Mm.
I remember it was quite the ritual in my house anyway. My dad and I would watch the Saturday morning Gazzetta, and it was always, you know, tremendous fun. And it was an insight into this world that we didn't know anything about. And actually, just you talking about Walter Zenga, my abiding memory of Walter Zenga is hair, jewellery. He always has a chain flapping around outside his shirt, which, you know, back in the days when footballers were still allowed to wear jewellery. And he seemed to chew gum like nobody's business, more than Sam Allardyce, more than Sir Alex. But I guess, Nikki, that you were probably a bit too young to watch Jimbo's show at the time, were you?
I definitely, like, watched it a bit. Like, I probably not the very first episodes of it, but I was definitely watching some Football Italia back then. Again, it was sort of a thing that you could do with Dad that was, like, a thing that he sort of, even though he didn't care about the football, like he was just sort of happy to like point to places and like talk about like, oh, you know, Italy, basically. I don't think it was, I don't know what year Jimbo started with that, but no, we definitely had that on, and that was definitely a thing I watched sometimes growing up. I don't know if it was ever like such a fixed ritual, and probably more, you know, what then becomes the sort of regular football watching at a certain point is Arsenal, which was really, again, like slightly me being a follower, because my brother started supporting Arsenal and I copied him.
Just before we go on to Arsenal, because your dad loved being Italian so much, like, did he, mm-hmm. like, was your house quite Italian? Like, I have this cliched image of, you know, Nonna's secret recipe, huge plates of meatballs and all that kind of stuff.
I think there was some like real contradictions with my dad, because like he was hugely proud of being Italian and wanted to talk about it a lot. But also like it was really important to him that my brother and I spoke like properly. Like, and you know, I'm aware that I have quite like a BBC RP sort of way of talking. And like, I do think that was like a really important thing to my dad, because I think he felt sometimes he was discriminated against back in, you know, his first time when he came to England, especially probably before, you know, I was around. Like, I think when he was first there in the 20s, I think being a sort of an Italian immigrant was a thing for a while that got you sort of a certain look down on in London. And so there was that going on. But I mean, no, there was lots of sort of, you know, we had big boxes of VHSs of Italian comedians and like things like that. I don't know what make it like an Italian household. My mum was English and did all the cooking, but she definitely cooked like Italian food. Like, she definitely had like learned the things that my dad wanted to eat and cooked that. So I don't know. It was definitely Italian in some ways. I mean, like, there's some things that like are stupid that I think are not like particularly profound, but you then realize that it's like isn't like something that's happening in most kids' households, which is my dad would come home from work every day and eat bread with olive oil. Like, he'd have like always like, not every day, but like a lot of the time it would be like sort of vaguely fresh bread and he'd have olive oil with it. And it's stupid, right? That's not a big deal, but like, yeah, most English kids' parents weren't doing that. So like there were things for sure.
Was he putting the balsamic vinegar in?
No, just salt and pepper. The balsamic thing, when like it became a trend in England, like years later, I was like, what's this balsamic nonsense? But Italy's so like that. Like, there's like really like rules are very strict in Italy, but they're often like completely about like wherever specifically you grow up. So like one place will say that's absolutely the way to do it. And another place will be like, you shouldn't do that at all.
You tweeted about Junior Gunner's bus trips when we canvassed for questions. Tell us about Junior Gunner's bus trips.
At some point, as I say, my brother, I think, started having an interest in Arsenal before I did, really. You know, I have very vague memories of things like the win at Anfield. And I think that's not even necessarily a memory. It's something that sort of got superimposed afterwards. I don't know, like stuff like that. But at a certain point, we did sort of start going to some games, and we went to Arsenal games. My dad would take us. My dad, again, wasn't even that interested. He was, you know, it was good like that, my dad. I have to say, like, he wasn't interested in football. There were other places he'd rather be, but he took us. And at some point, we did some away trips as well, which was a thing. I don't even know if it's a thing now, because as like an adult, you're so much more aware of like how much harder this must be to organize in terms of like having like adults who are background checked approved and all these things. But yeah, like, the Junior Gunners used to basically just run away trips where you'd go to Highbury and you'd get on the bus and there'd be a few adults and a bus for the kids, and they'd take you to an away game and they'd drop you off back there at the end of the day. And when I look back on it, like, it just seems a bit mad, because you'd have, I don't know what it was, like 30 or 40 kids from probably, I would guess, maybe like ages of like 8 to sort of mid-teenage years. And where you got sort of put in stadiums really vary. Like, sometimes you'd be in with the away fans and sometimes you'd be in the family enclosure. And like, I remember going to Old Trafford and we lost and we were just surrounded by United fans, and like, they weren't being nice to us because we were kids. Like, they were like, you know, in our faces celebrating, all the rest of it. Like, I remember that. I remember going to a Middlesbrough game where we won, and then like on the bus.
God, that's a journey as well. Like, coach to Middlesbrough.
I mean, again, as an adult, you have a different perspective, right? But probably for our parents, it was like, great, they're gone for a day.
Of course,
like,
yeah.
Out of the way on the whole weekend day. But yeah, I remember like being on the bus back from Middlesbrough, and like one kid started, I think we won 3-2, like was doing the gesture of the scoreline out the window at a car on the way back. And then suddenly you had all these Middlesbrough fans like leaning out the windows, swearing at us, like doing wanker gestures. Like, it was a really weird thing when I look back on it, but it was fun. Like, you know, as a kid, like all of that stuff seems like very like silly. But the United game in particular, I do remember thinking like, this is a bit uncomfortable. Like, there's some very aggressive people around and like we're children or like early teenagers.
The Junior used bus was slightly different. I mean, I seem to remember, I never went to one without my dad. I'm going to Watford away and just somebody, a kid behind me eating too many flying saucers and just hurling up like the sugariest, sweetest vomits on a coach to Watford.
I remember like one of the bus trips, like, because my mum would give us like, I don't know, packed lunch or whatever. And like one time she'd given us these pepperamis, but they were like turkey pepperamis. And I remember opening it, like the second you opened it, you're like, this stinks. Yeah, and you're on this bus full of people. And you're like, oh God, I'm that kid.
Who were your heroes then? Footballing heroes?
Yeah. I think Arsenal players, like it fits in the same mold as the Zenga thing to some extent, because it's like the ones who are most expressive and most colourful were the ones I loved the most. So like I remember being a really big fan of Paul Merson, and of course Ian Wright. Like Ian Wright was absolutely hero number one because he scored all the goals and he was such like a brilliant character. And like I think, yeah, like Ian Wright was really one of those people who, like, I remember at the time, like I would get like personally upset when people were critical of him. And I remember, like, even after, like, when he was sort of making his first sort of moves into doing TV stuff, and there was like some people who were being hostile to him, and like I would take it really personally about Ian Wright, because he just, to me, was just this totally like pure joyful character. And of course nobody's totally pure and joyful, but it has been really sort of lovely seeing him develop into like a broadcaster who I still absolutely adore, and who is I think one of the best out there, frankly.
Yeah, and a national treasure, isn't he? Like nobody can dislike Ian Wright.
I hated Ian Wright.
Why?
I hated him. Yeah. I don't know. I thought he had, I don't know, a cockiness and a swagger and a nasty streak that I think I'd admire now in players, but for some reason I just didn't particularly like Arsenal, and he seemed to embody everything I didn't like about Arsenal. And now I couldn't love Ian Wright more, but it's weird just how our opinions completely differ.
Yeah. Okay. Sort of fast forward and to sort of when you decided to work in football. I mean, I don't know if I've sort of missed a huge chunk of, you know, from being a kid to being to thinking about what you're going to do with your life. When was the moment where you thought, oh, this could be a profession for me?
Yeah, I do sometimes think like there's a certain amount of it was like falling in by accident, which is crazy when you think about how competitive an industry it is and how hard it is to do. When I was at university, I had one sort of like, again, it wasn't even as direct, like this is a step along the path, but like a thing that happened was I went to Warwick University, and I was there right as they were launching, well, it wasn't the launch, it's like the second year or something of the student university TV channel, which back then was, you know, calling it a channel was a stretch. I don't know what they do now, but back then it was basically we'd sort of all make our little programs and put them together for ourselves. And like, I think like once a week they aired our stuff in the student union for like 20 minutes or something. But I'd heard about it, and I went along to like the student, to like that they had a day like at the beginning of the university's year where they were like, right, we're going to elect our heads of departments. And I went along sort of out of curiosity as much as anything. I just kind of wanted to meet people and see if it was something I was interested to do. And they were like, oh, do you want to put your name down for head of department? And I was like, I don't know, like, what have you got? And there was like a head of news and like a head of comedy, and then there was a head of sport. And I was like, yeah, sure, put me down for the head of sport. And then like there was this like election in this, I don't know, it's like a Roman university. And they were sort of, people were coming up and giving these pitches about why they should be the head of news or the head of sport, head of documentaries, whatever. It's all very like, you know, in that student way, like it makes it sound very grand when it isn't. Like it's, you know, it's
yeah,
like,
it's really tragic. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's for like 20, like, you know, gawky students in a room together. But anyway, when it got to the sport, like no one else stood up. It was just me. And so I still went up there and was like, I don't know what to say. And so I made all sorts of absolutely impossible promises about like things I was going to do. Oh yeah, we're going to live broadcast like, you know, the top university sports teams games to the union, things that were just technically not within the realms of what we could do. Anyway, so I got that and spent a year doing a terrible shows for Warwick University TV, but had a lot of fun doing it, learned some stuff about how all that stuff works, which is really interesting. Then kind of left it for a while because I finished university and I had like a really interested the time of working in TV. So I came out of university and my sort of first career job, it was a winding path even to this, but my first career job is working as a researcher and runner for a TV documentary company and on a big word series that was for BBC called Balderdash and Piffle. It was actually a really fun thing to work on. Had Victoria Corrin hosting it, who in her sort of peak poker playing days, remember there was always like a negotiation of like, can we start a filming day at like 10 a.m. and she'd be like, oh, it's a bit early. Like that was the sort of, I did that, and during that was hankering a bit for like something more urgent because we spent like 9 months making this TV series, which was fun, but it was slow going. I was thinking I could skip a step, and I've realized by skipping a step, I've made this more confusing. Because basically, right, so because I had sort of been interested in doing that TV work, right after university, I took a 1 year working visa in Canada because you could. I found out from someone at university that, like, you were entitled to, as a British citizen, like, just have a 1 year working visa in Canada up to the age of 30. I thought, I want to do that. That sounds interesting. So I'd done that, gone and worked in, you know, nothing too serious. I was working in a kitchen most of the time I was over there. Right before doing that, I'd done some work experience in TV. And while I was doing work experience in TV, I had met someone who was able to get me a week's work experience at the Guardian Sports Desk as well. So I'd had 1 week's work experience at the Guardian Sports Desk.
Was it Barry?
No, it wasn't Barry, no. So I got 1 week's work experience right before going away on that sort of year. Well, it didn't end up being a year because I got this job offer to come back for the Bulls National PFL series, but 6 months, whenever I was in Canada. And I had enjoyed it, and I'd stayed in touch basically with the Guardian Sports Desk. So when I came back and I was doing my work for the TV documentary series, I you know, was a researcher runner. They paid you peanuts. It was really hard to live in London and afford to live in London. And I got back in touch with the Guardian Sports Desk, and I got, during that time, I did some night shifts. I don't know if Baz will remember this role, but there was like a night uploader and night editor role. And yeah, you'd come in and you would, because that was, the Guardian was like ahead of everyone in putting all the newspaper content online. The job was literally like, newspaper content drops into an online management system. You need to put it on the website and make the pages look nice. So I did have my sort of foot in the door a bit at the Guardian. To me, it didn't feel at the time like journalism work. Like, it felt like it was just like an extra sort of like, you know, temping job to make some extra money so I could afford to be in London. Yeah, that relationship definitely then helps me, because at the end of my time on the TV documentary series, I decided I didn't want to go into journalism. I went and did a 20-week NCTJ journalism course at Highbury College in Portsmouth. And during that time, I got some more work experience at The Guardian because they wanted you to do that as part of the course. And at the end of that course, right as we were doing the exams, actually, it was a 2006 World Cup, and The Guardian needed more hands on deck in the office during the day. So I went from having done the night shifts before to doing some day shifts on the Guardian online sports desk, which, again, as Baz knows, was completely separate to the newspaper desk at that time. There was the online desk and the newspaper desk. And yeah, it all kind of went from there. Like, right after the World Cup, a really lovely journalist, someone I think was a brilliant journalist, but obviously decided to go and take a different path. Georgie left the Guardian sports desk, and there was an open spot. And for a while, they had us doing shift work. It was me and a few others. And at a certain point, I got offered a press association traineeship. And I said to the Guardian, I'm going to take this unless you give me a job. And incredibly, they did give me a job. So I stayed.
Which was after, as Peter writes, you did work experience at the Leamington Courier, which included yes, a feature about what was on your MP3 player. Do you remember what was on your MP3
player? No.
You were doing work experience at the Leamington
Courier. Do you remember what an MP3 player is?
Good question. All right, that'll do for part one. We'll be back in a tick.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Every day is filled with opportunities to express yourself. And with an everyday piece from Blue Nile, you can do it without saying a word. Blue Nile's collection of diamond jewelry is the ultimate statement, with sparkle that elevates any outfit. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, their diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Joseph says, no questions. Just want to say, as an American listener, I've always enjoyed Nicky's wisdom and gentle humour. I don't know how you are with compliments, Nicky. I don't get many, so I find it much easier to take the insults. I don't know if her personal life will be touched on, but having just recently learned more about her, please pass on my admiration for her courage and grace. Pylon says, I'm pretty sure it's out of bounds, but I'd love to hear about her transition. I kind of feel she might not want to talk about this unless I'm wrong. But I was wondering if everything went well for her, especially in Italy. Look, we talked about this very briefly on the pod, on the LGBTQ plus special we did a few months ago. And obviously we've talked about it before. You're sort of happy to talk about this and aware that if me or Barry ask something stupid or get our language wrong or whatever, you will instantly pull us up on it.
Yeah, no, I think it's probably like pretty unrealistic to try and have any sort of discussion of my life that doesn't bring it in, because I mean, as I already mentioned, I got sent to an all boys school when I was a kid, which, you know, now feels like something really odd, but yeah, it's hard not to talk about it. So, you know, within reason, I'm open to talking about it.
So like, what age do you feel different? Is that a silly question?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's a silly question. It's a complicated question, because I think like people in all sorts of things in their like self-understanding arrive at like mature understandings of themselves at different ages. You know, some people have a very sort of clear idea of who they are when they're very little, and some people don't. And I'm not just talking about gender here, you know, like I've heard people talk about this with reference to things they wanted to do in their life, to like, you know, their interests, to like the things that become their, that shape their career, to their sexualities as well. Like some people talk about knowing very clearly that they fancy people of certain genders when they're very little, and some people don't. And I think all those things are like, yeah, like things that you can come to at different levels of clarity. And I think like as a kid, I can sort of talk about all sorts of things that seemed obvious to me. Like it seemed obvious to me that it would be better if I was a girl, but like it didn't seem like a real thing to like do. Mm. Like it didn't seem like that was an option. And that was just, you know, one of those things that you had. We're all shaped by like the course of events around us as well. And, you know, I think I was probably wrestling with it much more for a little while as I sort of approached the teenage years, and then something quite big happened in my life, which was that my father passed away. And I think like there was a real moment for me of like, you mustn't cause a fuss now. Like, you know, like things are quite hard at the moment, and like now's a good time to like just get on with everything. And I think we probably all did that as a family. I shouldn't talk too much about the rest of my family, but I think we all sort of had this sort of mindset for a long time of, you know, if nobody's dying, then everything's all right. And I think it's sort of a juncture that, who knows if you go back in time, how things might have worked out differently, but you sort of go down a different path. And then after that, it becomes something that you sort of swallow for a long time, and other things happen in life. And you, I don't know. I think you can get to a point with certain sort of things, and I don't know if I like the word denial, because denial is like sort of implies you're doing something really consciously to me. And I think it's not always as conscious as that, but I think you do sort of, and again, I think it doesn't just refer to gender. I think people do this with all sorts of parts of themselves, but you sort of tell yourself that something isn't important. You tell yourself that, yeah, this isn't great, but I can deal with it. This isn't great, but I can deal with it. And some of those things over time just creep up on you, and they become more and more a thing that you realize you have to deal with. And yeah, you know, I think there's a big part that goes on behind the scenes that even sort of, though this is no longer talking about childhood, this is adulthood, and it's much more recent. I think now when I try and think back clearly about like the process of how you get to where you are today, some of it seems sort of hard to even sort of recall with clarity, because there was so much emotion going on. There was so much difficult stuff going on. But I went to therapy for a long time. Like I went to therapy for a long time, and I started talking about these things I hadn't talked about. And at the beginning of that therapy, I still was telling myself that we wouldn't end up where we are today, because it seemed like something impossible and horrible. And like, it was just going to destroy my life, and everyone was going to hate me, and that was going to be the end of everything. And, you know, I'm quite glad that has worked out not to be the case. There was some horrible, difficult bits along the way, but I feel like I've sort of arrived at the other side of it quite happy.
I sort of, over time, does it become more all-consuming? Like, because we were talking about these things, like, oh, I went to Canada for 6 months, I was working on this documentary, and it's sort of hard enough to do all these things and, you know, working weekend shifts. Was this at the front of your mind for all of that? Or is there days where you just don't sort of think about it?
I think there's plenty of days when you don't think about it, because there's, of course, there's days when you don't think about your gender, like you're busy. And I think one thing I've always been very good at is keeping myself busy. You know, Canada's an interesting chapter again, because I could point to some very clear memories that happened at the time. Like, you know, before I went to Canada, I think honestly in my entire life, very possibly I'd met someone without knowing, but I'd never knowingly met a trans person. And so like the only exposure I'd had to trans people was in, God, I remember reading one newspaper article about a guy in England who was sort of a trans guy. And I remember trans women on Jerry Springer. That's where I remember seeing trans people when I was growing up. And then I went to Canada and I met some trans people very briefly. Like, they still weren't sort of people who I sort of saw regularly. They were just the people who I sort of, whose paths I crossed with briefly. There were moments in that period when it was like, you know, maybe you should try and actually like find those people and talk to them about these things and do it. But again, like, you know, some things sort of, I don't know, it's hard again to explain with clarity what I'm thinking when I'm 20 years old, because I'm not 20 years old anymore. It's a long time ago. But some things just seem so sort of impossible that you just sort of tell yourself that's impossible. And so, you know, you can feel sad about it. And there was lots of sort of times when there was sadness about it, or like, you know, angst of some kind about it, but you don't necessarily take the next logical step, which is that I can do something about this. And again, I do think like I was very good and have always been good at being busy. Like, I'm very good at like, oh, I'm going to just go to work, do the work I'm going to do. Oh, I'm going to go and keep myself socially busy and go and like have friendships. And I, in some ways, when you talk about doing those two jobs when I was starting out, that's like the prime example of just be busy, like just keep working. And, you know, that's a good thing to do. And work has always been one thing that I think I feel like nobody can tell you off for. Like, if you're doing work, then you're providing a good value to the world, and that's a good thing to be doing.
So then that moment where, oh man, it's probably not a moment, is it, where you actually can't, you realize or you decide you can do something about this, is that a moment of liberation, or is that an incredibly stressful time, or both?
I think it's too simple to call it a moment. You know, I had a coming out moment to my then spouse. I was married. I think that's been talked about on the podcast before as well. Who's someone who is an incredible person who I'm still very lucky to have in my life. But I, you know, that was the first person I ever said anything to about it in the world, and it was not a liberating, fun moment. It was a panic attack and a breakdown. Yeah, that was sort of an incredibly difficult moment that was sort of a first moment, if you want to talk about moments. And then I suppose there's moments along the way after that that are different levels of difficult and joyful. Like, there is joyfulness that comes, but it's not a moment for me. Like, there's sort of steps that sort of you get to, but I think especially like probably because of that relationship, which was a great relationship and is, you know, is still a great relationship, just a different kind of relationship. I think that sort of unpicking that became its own story. But even before that, again, like, it wasn't like I sort of had this moment of like clarity, like I'm going to transition. I had this moment of, I need to talk about this. Like, I can't, you know, continue forever not talking about something that is in my head so often. And you know, that's where it starts. And so, yeah, where the sort of moment is, I don't know after that. Like, everything sort of feels like it's more of a process that unfolds.
There was this time where you'd come out privately, but, you know, you were working with us and with other people, and you hadn't. And that must have been a very strange time.
Yeah, it was an incredibly awkward time, to be honest. Because again, but then, you know, coming out comes in different forms. You know, the coming out to my ex is, I need to talk about this. Coming out to, you know, close friends and family is, at first, that relationship is breaking down, because everyone knows you in your relationships, don't they? And I need to explain to you why that's happening. And that's still not the point of me saying, and I'm transitioning. That's the point of me saying, like, there's some hard stuff I'm going through. And yeah, then there is this process, as you say, of actually sort of starting to take steps towards what will eventually become you know, it's a medical process as well. In my case, it isn't for everybody. Everybody has their own journey. And yeah, as you're sort of starting to make those steps, there's sort of this growing awareness that you are going to have to go, because you do a public facing job, you're going to have to go public, which was a really stressful, hard time, because you're sort of constantly worried about, is someone going to work this out before I say something? And also, like, when is the right time to say something? And I had some help from someone really wonderful who actually, again, my ex introduced me to, who deals with crisis communications for companies, who like talked to me about like how you can approach these things differently. And you know, she said to me, like, you know, you can, there are really like two big options, which is that you either let the information just leak out slowly and you don't have this sort of big sort of moment of everyone focusing on you, and there's some advantages to that and disadvantages to that, or you take ownership of it, and the advantage of that is you take ownership of it. There's no gossip, there's no one said things. And so there was a decision point about doing that, which obviously is when I write my article and do a video, but like there's a build-up period in which, yeah, you're worried about how you're being perceived. Obviously, I was growing my hair out, which of course people are going to joke about, like, of course they are, like, that's like a normal thing to do.
I cringe at me and Barry, like,
oh yeah,
you just joking about you having a sort of midlife crisis or just something, I can't remember, like, you'd come, you know, on the pod and I just think, oh, you know,
my toes still curl when I think back to, I think you'd moved to Brighton, you're growing your hair long, and you were talking about going clubbing, and it was a running joke that, you know, your midlife crisis. And then when you made your big announcement, I just, oh Christ, I mean, it was so much to deal with,
yeah,
you know, as a standalone thing. But then obviously, being completely self-centered, I immediately thought, oh Christ, I'm going to look really bad here.
I honestly think, like, you know, I think the majority of people who I work with have been brilliant. I think this podcast has been brilliant. I really do. Like, and that goes to you as well, Baz. Like, you don't need to feel like guilty about things you said when, like, you know, you didn't know. Like, there's not a thing that you should feel bad about. There's only a very small minority of people within journalism who, at least to my face, I'm sure things have been said about me when I haven't been present, have been unpleasant. And yeah, you know, I get it. Like, I have friends. Like, if your friend suddenly starts acting differently, you're going to say something about it. And if you're a real friend, probably, like, your natural mode is to joke about it rather than to say something earnest, because, well, I mean, you said earlier, Max, I did live in America for 2 years. They're often a bit more earnest in America, but in England, generally, when someone, you know, wants to be sincere with a friend, they make a joke, don't they?
I remember really overthinking, like, when you were first coming in, and sort of, like, wanting to be sort of over supportive going in. I'd obviously, like, you'd come on the pod, I'd just say all right, and when he came, I was like, oh, do I, no, you know, I should give you a hug. And then I just didn't remember going, you sort of saying, oh, we're hugging, are we? And we're going, oh shit, maybe I shouldn't have, oh fuck.
What, I was being awkward, right? Like, I was awkward in that moment. I'm sort of interacting with all of you guys in a different way in the first time, so like it's awkward for everyone, like, and I'm there sort of feeling very guilty for making people feel awkward. Like, it's never been a thing I want in my life, to make other people feel awkward. I mean, god, that's a whole different topic, frankly, because sometimes when you read too many news headlines, it's like existing as being trans can be made to feel like it's something that's putting everyone else out, which is, you know, not why anyone transitions. I think we muddled through pretty well. Honestly, I think we muddled through pretty well.
How do you, to be fair to Baz, you did that video and his first tweet was, I thought it was big news, I thought you were joining The Athletic, was really, really funny.
Yes, yeah.
That video, like, it knocked me sideways. I had a little heads up, I think an hour before it was posted, and it completely knocked me sideways. It's probably the most shocking news I've ever heard in my entire life. And I was really worried on your behalf that people will be unpleasant to you. Or I'm just wondering, has that happened? Like, say, on trains or just walking down the street or going about your business, whatever.
I think that's like a really sort of interesting, when you go through the looking glass, which sometimes it feels like I have, you do get this very odd experience of people treating you differently. And it becomes hard in lots of situations to know when like you're being treated differently because you're being perceived as one thing or another. Like, is this because I'm transgender? Is this because I'm a woman? Like, these things are unclear. Like, when I talk about in our work, like, if someone's posting under a YouTube video, as has happened, oh, back in the kitchen, whatever, oh, that's probably just straightforward sexism. Someone is lamenting, you know, when did Sky Sports get so woke? Is that because I'm trans or is it because I'm a woman? It could be either, because I'm on there with another woman, you know, Mina Rizuki, and like that could be either, right? Like, you know, that stuff is blurry. I think, you know, probably more earlier in my transition, there was some overtly transphobic stuff that went on. Like, and yes, I've been shouted at in the street. I've had sort of some up close personal abuse from people who I've never met in my life, which is not a pleasant thing to happen. And yeah, then there's also like the other part of it, which is things that every woman journalist who covers sport deals with. There's been situations like even coming back from the Euros final, going back to my hotel in London, there was a guy sort of following me and saying sexual stuff and then, you know, calling me a frigid bitch and all the rest of it. And like me having to sort of scurry by Marylebone to like a random couple I saw walking just so I was walking with someone. It definitely like it is less safe in society in lots of situations to not be perceived as a man. Like that is a thing. And again, like the times when it's about being trans can be horrible, and the times when it's about being a woman can be horrible, and they're both sort of present and yeah. Unfortunate side effects, I suppose, to getting to live in a more authentic way.
There's probably not an exact answer to this question either, I guess, but you know, and this pod is about you and your career and your life. It's not about trans rights, right? Whether in sport or anything else. I wonder, as you know, do you become more comfortable in your own skin as every year goes by, but does it get harder to be is it becoming harder to be trans or easier to be trans? I mean, the headlines would, you know, would perhaps mean it's harder. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that question. I think there's sort of, in some areas, greater acceptance, and in some areas, quite plainly, sort of greater hostility. I mean, right now, we're the political football. Like, I'm sure, you know, well, not I'm sure, like, clearly migration still is for lots of people as well. But right now, like, the number one culture wars topic in this country and in America is trans people. And, you know, every British newspaper, including the one that publishes this podcast, has carried some articles that I personally think have been incredibly unhelpful. And I think there's this sort of constant linking of trans people with crimes committed by a sort of tiny minority that is being re-imprinted over and over again as what people think about when they think about trans people, in the same way as after terrorist attacks, the media will just impress on the population that this is a Muslim problem, for instance, as was certainly the case for a long time in Britain. Now this is a trans problem, and you know, most people in the world don't care about it, but enough do that you do get nasty, scary people out there who are going to do nasty, scary things and attack you for it. So it is a bad time in that regard. And you know, this comes to things that I think a lot of trans people do, and you know, trans is a big umbrella, and different people experience their lives in different ways. But as someone who I suppose has transitioned in quite a binary way, there are definitely times when you just sort of hope for your safety that you're not being perceived as trans, because it's just easier to just be perceived as not that because of those risks. But speaking sort of just personally, which is all I can do, I've tried in most things to just get on with it and do what I've always done in my life, which is just to be myself and let people take me as they take me. You do have to weigh that up in some situations against personal safety. And as I talked about at the time, there's, for instance, the Qatar World Cup. It was simplified for me because Italy didn't qualify, but could I have gone and been safe? I don't know the answer to that. And that stuff's pretty grim.
Philippa York does punditry on major cycling events, and a couple of weeks ago, I think it might have been during the Giro d'Italia, her co-commentator referred to her successes when she was cycling under the name Robert Miller, a very, very successful Scottish cyclist. And I noticed somebody a couple of people on Twitter got very offended on her behalf because he had dead named her, you know, used her Robert Miller name that she used to go by. And she went on Twitter and said, look, I have no problem with this. I was a cyclist. I rode under the name of Robert Miller. Now I'm Philippa York. And these people continued to be offended on her behalf. And I just found it really weird, their attitude, and very unhelpful as well. I'm not sure what kind of point I'm trying to make here, but maybe it's just the toxicity of this ongoing debate. But when she had made it clear, I have no problem with my co-commentator referring to my successes as Robert Miller and using that name. I've made it clear I have no problem with it. And they still said, no, he's bang out of order. He shouldn't have done that. He's offending all trans people.
I think that's a complicated dynamic. I didn't follow this story, so I don't know anything about it. And I think that everyone has the right to sort of experience things like their old names as they do. And if that's how Philippa feels, then I would certainly say, well, that's Philippa's thing to worry about, not mine. But I also understand that for a lot of trans people, it is something that they prefer not to have talked about. I think it's harder for those of us who were public figures before transitioning, because you kind of can't as easily sort of just sort of pretend that wasn't a thing. So you experience that differently. But I understand everyone's emotion in that. And I do think if there was one thing that I think would benefit this whole discourse, honestly, it would be that tomorrow someone just deleting Twitter from the world, because I think it was already an unhelpful place in many of these discussions. And I think that since a particularly unhelpful, willfully unhelpful person took charge, it's become an even more unhelpful place for these discussions.
Nikki, thanks so much. I mean, I don't know if it means a lot, but I just don't, honestly, and just see you as someone who's good on the pod. You know, that's it. And that's sort of how it should be, right?
I think that's all you really want. That's all you really want. It's just to be able to get on. Well, it's all I wanted. I can't speak for anyone else, but all I wanted was to be able to get on with life and be myself. And I think that this podcast has always allowed me that.
All right. Well, we'll do more in just a second.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly Life and Times special with Nikki Bandini. Sam says, I know Nikki is a gooner like myself. Does she have an Italian team? I've always assumed it was Inter.
So the real answer now is that I don't. And I think, like, if you spent a season even in my shoes covering the league and experiencing that way, you do experience these things differently. And I think that really, like, what you want as a journalist is interesting stories, and that's the number one thing. But if you'd asked me when I was, I don't know, 15 or 16, because all my cousins sport Inter, I definitely had a soft spot for Inter. And if you have paid attention to the podcast long enough, you'll know that I even had some cousins not so long ago who were on the books at Inter. So yes, I have some connections to Inter that are probably a bit different. But you know, the best way I can explain it is what I've always sort of said, which is, in my dream world, where Arsenal are winning the league every season, I wouldn't get bored of that. Whereas if Inter won the league, I would be happy for my cousins, but I kind of would be more hoping the next season they didn't win it again, because it's more interesting to write about. If you've got different teams winning, if you've got competition.
Football changes when you work in it, doesn't it? In every way, I think. Tony says, why are there such differences between Italian and English football? Do you think these differences will diminish over time as we import, export more players and managers?
It's way too big a question, because it goes to how you're brought up, like how you experience football, like everything, like in your national culture affects how your football is different, which is why every country has its own sort of football identity and different things. The sort of big picture of is it different? Yes, it is. I mean, you know, Italian football has got a different mindset that I think comes to cultural things. And do managers go crossing countries change things? Yes, they definitely do, right? Like there's so much sort of cross sort of cultural learning that goes on at the highest level of football anyway. And I think Italy in some ways was ahead of the curve on this anyway, because there's a manager school at Coverciano where managers are all writing their thesis every time they graduate, and you've got this sort of desire to in some ways make it academic. I think there's always been some of that, but I think the countries never completely lose what they are, because still the majority of managers, the majority of sort of players in the pyramid, maybe not in the top divisions, are still growing up in Italy with an Italian outlook on the world.
You've interviewed some, you know, pretty big Italian stars, you know, Totti, Buffon, etc. Do you have a most memorable one or memorable moment covering Italian football?
I mean, some of the most memorable moments covering Italian football were honestly this season, because a Milan derby in the semi-final of the Champions League is something that you don't, you know, you don't get to experience. So getting to cover those both for Stan was something really special. Interview is without question Gigi Buffon. I've interviewed him a few times, but there was one in particular, which was my second sit down with him. And I was doing it for 8x8 magazine, and they had a photographer, Roger Neve, who's this brilliant Dutch photographer who I think does a lot of fashion. I don't think I know, he does a lot of fashion shooting as well. And he's got this way of sort of disarming footballers. Like he manages to sort of get them to lean into the silliness of like these stupid photo shoots that he does. And I think he sort of helped me on that occasion to really sort of bring out the playfulness and the fun in Buffon. And we ended up having this sort of huge conversation that went on for a really long time. And I'd come in with, as I always do, I never come with like a fixed list of questions, but I come with like topics I think I'm going to talk about. And I had a big list of topics I wanted to talk about. And instead we got into this like whole conversation about the meaning of life. And I was just like, I don't know, like it was one of those really like cool moments where you're like, I'm sat here with Gigi Buffon, who at a certain point before I was doing this was this sort of mythic figure, and he's talking to me about what he thinks the meaning of life is. And yeah, it was a really cool conversation. So
did you and Gigi Buffon work out the meaning of life?
Do you know what's awful as I'm saying that, I'm thinking I can't remember exactly what he said, so you'll have to go back and double check the interview. But I mean he talked about I'm going to say go find it, because I'll butcher it and it won't be as good as he said it. So yeah, go and find it. Maybe I'll see if I can find the link, and because I'm pretty sure it's online, and get Joel to post it in the notes. But that was a really fun interview. I've been really lucky to have some really really fun interviews in my career, and but that definitely stands out.
I want to touch on the States a bit. I mean, our timeline's all over the place, but look, when did you go, and was that sort of NFL based, or did your love of NFL come from being over there?
No, my NFL enthusiasm is another thing that goes back to friends in school, like, you know, something that the
Channel 4 and Mick Luckhurst and Gary Imlach.
No, it was a bit late for that. It was Sky Sports. I first got interested in the NFL because we had a family holiday to America where we met some family friends of my parents, and had the game explained to me and was like, oh, this is better than I thought it would be. This is less sort of boring and inscrutable than I thought it was. And then I came back and talked to someone at school who was like, oh, I love the NFL. And so we sort of developed an interest from there. Going to America in 2012 was actually like nothing to do with me. My ex got a Fulbright scholarship to study in the States, and I was like, yeah, go on, let's do it. Why not? Like, how many times do you get this random excuse to go and live in a different country, and Missouri of all places? And it was a really cool experience. I mean, you talk about interviews, but I ended up writing the autobiography of Jimmy Nielsen, who was a player for Sporting Kansas City at the time, and that's a series of interviews, but that's probably even more enjoyable interviews, because that was really someone who, like, when you're doing an autobiography, like, they want to let you get under their skin and understand everything. That was a real privilege and a fun thing to do.
Owen says, is there the same sort of snobbery or stigma around British people covering the NFL as there is here when we hear an American covering football?
I think there's like shock when like you talk to Americans and they're like, oh, you actually understand. But to be honest with you, like, I mean, this is another of those things that, like, when I talk about the looking glass moments, you know, I covered the last Super Bowl for The Guardian, and like I had more than one cab driver, like when I was telling them I was there for the Super Bowl, being like, oh, but do you really like it? Like, are you really into it? Like, do you actually understand it? And like, that's, you know, that's sexism basically. But like, you know, it's definitely like combined with the English accent, I'm sure, like, part of it. I actually sort of look back on that and think it was such a sort of odd thing. Cause for a while I was doing a regular column for the NFL's UK office on the St. Louis Rams. Cause at the time they were the London team that came over every year. And I remember like having this conversation with them. The reporters there, like the regular beat reporters, like a couple of them in like the press room at the Rams training facility. And at the time I hadn't covered a single NFL regular season game, but I'd covered several Super Bowls. And like I said this, and like all these guys who cover the sport every like week who've never got to cover a Super Bowl are like, sure. Excuse me, like what?
Yeah.
So yeah, like it's
massive glory hunting.
Yeah, exactly.
Just fly in for the big games. Sebo says, favorite city in Italy and why? Non-footballing reasons. Can you get the best pasta there, or is that somewhere else?
Well, the good news is I am going to say the place that I think you get the best pasta, which is Bologna. The reason is that I'm biased because my dad's hometown is like an hour away in the hills, but so you'd always go through Bologna, and I get to go there a lot. But I think Bologna is like, I put it right at the top of places I'd tell people who have got like a bit of interest in Italian football to have a city break. Cause you go to Bologna, best pasta in the country, in my opinion. Obviously, like the reason we call it spaghetti bolognese in England is actually ragu from Bologna originally. It's something a bit different over there, but it's amazing. But they also have cappelletti and brodo. There's all sorts. And I really like it as well, just to visit, because it's not too big, Bologna. You can like station yourself quite centrally and just walk everywhere. It's really pretty. You've got the little towers, like all of it is gorgeous. And the football stadium, again with a little tower, is I think one of the sort of understated lovely places to go. Obviously go to San Siro, like whatever you do, go to San Siro while it's still in use. But Renato Dell'Ara is also a lovely stadium to go to.
Henrik says, what is Sticky's desert island Italian meal? And is it from a specific restaurant or homemade?
I mean, I think probably like if I was choosing one meal, it would be...
Yeah.
I was going to say my mum's lasagna, but I can make it too now. So like it's my lasagna. Okay. Like I think lasagna like done well is really, really good. But it's a desert island, so it's quite hot. Do you want something that stodgy?
If you want lasagna on a desert island, you don't really want, you know, because I... Yeah.
Shouldn't the question be your death row meal rather than your...
Maybe.
Desert, because you're going to get sick of it if you're having it every single day on a desert island.
Your death row meal is your own lasagna, which means you get to cook. So you like you could slow cook the ragu and sort of give yourself a bit more time.
And shank the prison guards with the knife.
That's absolutely true.
Try to escape.
Finally, Matt says, favourite Italian expression?
I think the one that's in my head is... non c'è più trippa per gatti, which is like there's no more tripe for the cats, which is such a weird, like ridiculous like phrase, like, but because tripe for the cats, but like, you know, it's I guess when you're in a more lavish state when there's tripe for the cats, and when there's not, things have changed.
Nikki, thanks so much for doing this. Thanks, appreciate it. It was great.
No probs, anytime.
Thanks, Baz.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.